Today is Wednesday, August 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a conviction and a guilty plea from two former associates of President Trump.
This is something that the president legitimately should be afraid of.
Renewed concerns over North Korea's nuclear activities. Also ahead, an American country rock band is breaking a big record. It's all on today's International Edition. Paul Manafort, the former campaign chair of President Donald Trump, was found guilty of eight financial crimes Tuesday in the first trial victory of the special counsel investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 campaign. A judge declared a mistrial on 10 other counts the jury couldn't agree on. President Trump responded to the verdict after arriving in the state of West Virginia for a campaign rally.
It doesn't involve me, but I still feel, it's a very sad thing that happens. This has nothing to do with Russian collusion. This started as Russian collusion. This has absolutely nothing to do. This is a witch hunt, and it's a disgrace.
President said the case against Manafort shows the special counsel's probe is a disgrace. The verdict was part of a stunning 1-2 punch of bad news for the White House, coming as the president's former attorney, Michael Cohen, pleaded guilty in New York to campaign finance charges arising from hush money payments made to two women who say they'd had sex with Trump. Federal prosecutor Robert Kazami announced Cohen's guilty plea.
Michael Cohen pled guilty to 8 felony charges. 5 of those dealt with tax evasion for the years 2012 through 2016, in which he failed to report approximately $4.1 million in reported income.
The outcome, though not the across-the-board guilty verdict, almost certainly guarantees years of prison for Manafort and Cohen and vindicates the ability of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team to secure convictions despite months of attacks from Trump. Joining us now is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, let's start with Manafort. We know it will take some time for the sentencing, but what comes next after that?
The next question for the prosecution is whether or not they're going to recharge the other 10 counts. There is also a trial that's coming up in Washington, D.C. on other charges against Paul Manafort. Even more than that, there is even the potential that he is facing charges in New York State based upon other issues that are out there that could actually come from the New York Attorney General. So there's a lot of things that Paul Manafort is looking for.
Do you think he's banking on a pardon from the president, and how likely do you think that would come?
When you look at what's going on right now, and you look at the evidence that the government actually had against him, it was very odd in some ways that he didn't negotiate a deal in this case. So I think he may actually be banking on a pardon. The problem that he faces is that even if he were pardoned on this case, even if he were pardoned on the Washington, D.C. case, that doesn't mean that you can actually be pardoned on a state conviction in New York. In addition to that, the president can't pardon anybody if what you're trying to do is obstruct an ongoing investigation. And there is absolutely an ongoing investigation right now.
As you've heard, the president has said it was very sad that he's a good guy and, again, calling the whole Russia investigation a witch hunt, saying this had nothing to do with Russia.
The problem is what we have is we have another person who has deep ties to Russian oligarchs and potentially even to the Kremlin itself. And the fact that there's a dovetailing of that issue, in addition to the fact that it provides additional support to the Robert Mueller investigation itself, I think Mueller comes out the winner in this particular case now.
Right. Of course, another person close to the president. On the same day that this was happening, the president's former attorney/fixer pled guilty to campaign finance laws for hush money payments and said that it was in coordination and under the direction of a, quote, candidate for president. And he made a plea deal. That pretty much implicates the candidate, which we know is President Trump.
What's significant about it is he's saying he committed a crime on behalf of somebody running for president. What that does is implicate the president directly. This is something that the president legitimately should be afraid of. Just that one little piece alone has the potential for having the president face actual charges here. When you have one person who commits a crime in support of somebody else and that other person was supporting that, that would be the co-conspirator concept. But remember, there's something bigger here. And the bigger part for Mr. Cohen is that he clearly going to be cooperating with Robert Mueller in this case. And the real question is what else he knows. And that information will help provide additional support to the Mueller investigation.
We didn't hear anything specifically that said that Michael Cohen was actually cooperating. We just heard that he made a plea deal for this case. How do we know he's cooperating?
The problem that Michael Cohen is facing right now is that he could be looking at upwards of 5 years. He could be looking at a lot less than 5 years. That means a lot to somebody like a Michael Cohen. And his willingness to cooperate is something that federal authorities and the court would certainly take into account. And so that's one of the things that the prosecutors are banking upon. The way the plea was accepted in this case, clear to me that there have been a lot of conversations directly with the prosecutor's office to allow him to plead in the way that he did to the charges that he faced. He could have been charged with a lot more than this, potentially. Could have been looking at a lot more years in prison. And the prosecutor's office would not have allowed this plea to go through itself unless there was a reason for them to do so. And part of that would be cooperation.
What would the legal repercussions be for the president? My understanding is a president cannot be indicted.
That's the interesting part of this, is that nobody really knows. We have never really seen this issue. There's one part of it that would say that this was a candidate for the presidency. So he was actually not president at the time that he allegedly committed a crime, if that's in fact were to come down the pike. Unless there is this obstruction / conspiracy piece once he took the seat. So there is that side of this. There are others who would claim that obstruction piece actually does expose him. The impeachment piece is a fundamentally different issue because while one is criminal, impeachment is specifically political in nature. And the real question at this point is whether or not the House, who has complete control about whether or not they would ever actually move to impeach this president, it would then go to the Senate for a trial. And at this point, even if the Democrats were capable of taking back the House, you still need two-thirds of that Senate to actually essentially convict for impeachment. So it strikes me as unlikely that you would get an impeachment conviction. The issue has very serious implications. This is about what Republicans could do or how they will see whether this president hurts or helps them, and also the American people themselves who will make a decision about whether or not this president is somebody they actually want to have continuing in office.
Could the president be prosecuted after he leaves office?
The answer to that is yes. Once this president leaves office, could he be prosecuted? If, in fact, there is enough information here that he was a co-conspirator with Michael Cohen on this fraud issue regarding the elections and disclosure, he could be indicted as a co-conspirator as soon as he walks away.
That's former Central Intelligence Agency officer and current criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. As the November midterm congressional elections draw closer, Republicans are keeping a close eye on President Donald Trump's approval rating, which now stands at an average of about 42%. Trump's historically low ratings dipped below 40% in a few recent surveys, possibly a reflection of the ongoing turmoil within the administration on a number of fronts. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
Clean thinking and suffer not our hatred.
Following an opening prayer at the White House, President Trump presides over a cabinet meeting where the economy was the central focus.
Our economy is doing better than it ever has before. It was going in the wrong direction when we came on board, and now it's doing better than ever before.
Trump is getting some credit from voters for the economy, says Gallup pollster Frank Newport.
We know that Trump's highest approval rating is now for handling the economy, 50% approval rating on handling the economy in our latest poll, and that's pretty good, relatively speaking.
But there have been plenty of distractions of late, including Trump's decision to revoke the security clearance for former CIA Director John Brennan and his spat with former White House aide Omarosa Manigault Newman. Trump's move on Brennan alarmed many Democrats, including Virginia Senator Mark Warner.
To me, smacks of Nixonian-type practices of trying to silence anyone who's willing to criticize this president. That puts us, again, in uncharted territory.
Trump's controversial immigration policies and widespread criticism of his recent summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin may also be keeping his poll numbers low, says analyst Larry Sabato.
And he's not a 50% president. He's never been over 50% in the polling averages for one single day of his presidency.
Trump's approval rating could have an impact on Republicans trying to keep their congressional majorities in November, says John Hudak.
The party of the president typically loses seats in a midterm election. That is enhanced by a president who is unpopular, and President Trump's approval rating has historically been unpopular, and it continues to be so.
Trump supporters believe that voters will give the president credit for the strong economy in November, including former campaign manager Corey Lewandowski.
Unemployment in our country, not just among middle-class white Americans like me, but Hispanics and African Americans, are at the lowest levels since recorded history in 1973. This president should be praised for that.
Trump remains popular with his base, but whether that is enough to stem a Democratic wave in November remains to be seen. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Syrian refugees are concerned over Russia's repatriation plan. President Trump rebuts a report he mulled during denying Obama intel access. Erdogan blames the West for Turkey's economic turmoil, and the Pope will meet with victims of clerical sexual abuse in Ireland. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The International Atomic Energy Agency says it appears that nuclear activities in North Korea have not stopped, despite its pledges to do so. A report released Tuesday says there are indications of the operations at a steam plant that serves as a radiochemical laboratory at one of the North's main nuclear sites. The report found that between late April and early May, there were indications consistent with the use of the reported centrifuge enrichment facility located within the plant prior to the meeting between North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un and U.S. President Donald Trump in Singapore in June. Pyongyang expelled IAEA inspectors in 2009. The watchdog has since stepped up monitoring through open source information and satellite imagery. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Bruce Bennett, senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation, what the IAEA is most concerned about.
They're concerned about evidence that North Korea is separating plutonium for use in nuclear weapons. They're also concerned about North Korea highly enriched uranium production. They're concerned that there's evidence that despite Kim's claim that he's prepared to denuclearize, that he hasn't even been freezing his force, let alone denuclearizing. He's actually been nuclearizing. He's probably built 5 to 8 nuclear weapons so far this year, and that's not good.
Is it a cause for grave concern, as the IAEA said?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about it. President Trump agreed to meet with Kim Jong-un because Kim Jong-un said he was going to abandon his nuclear weapons. This is a classical North Korea bait and switch. Kim Jong-un promised one thing. He's now refusing to do any kind of denuclearization. And after his meeting in Singapore, he went home to North Korea. And according to several sources I have, he's briefed the senior elites that he was never going to give up his nuclear weapons, that they were key to regime survival. So President Trump probably would have never met with him unless he offered to abandon his nuclear weapons. Now he's reneging. That's a concern because it looks like he's going to keep building, and that then pushes the U.S. into some escalated response against him.
Mr. Trump, in an interview Monday with Reuters, said he believed the North had taken specific steps toward denuclearization, and he would, quote unquote, most likely meet again with the North Korean leader. Is that a little premature?
I don't think it's premature. I think Trump is trying to give Kim Jong-un every opportunity to prove that he's prepared to do this. If, in the end, Kim Jong-un refuses to do what he's promised to do, then President Trump can, with good conscience, say, okay, now we've got to do something more serious because a North Korea with hundreds of nuclear weapons is something we will not accept. And so he's going to give Kim every opportunity, but eventually Kim's going to wear out the possibilities.
The IAEA acknowledged in its statement that its verification of the North's intentions is limited and, in fact, the knowledge base declining. But is there any doubt in your mind that the North is not denuclearizing?
Oh, I don't think there's any reason to believe that. If the North were really doing it, they would have every reason to demonstrate their good faith to win support in South Korea. We have to remember that they are constantly operating in the court of public opinion in South Korea. It's almost as if Kim is running for the president of South Korea in 2022, which is to say he wants, just like President Moon of South Korea wants, a confederation. Only Kim Jong-un wants to dominate it, but he's got to have South Korean support to do that. So he's trying to tell everybody that he's being Mr. Good Guy, and it's time that we now turn the tables on him and explain that, no, he's really not doing what he's promised to.
Is the Moon administration choosing to ignore the latest evidence that denuclearization is not happening?
Oh, I don't think that. The Moon administration has a different problem. The Moon administration's problem is simply getting Kim to reduce a few nuclear weapons still leaves them with a threat. They've got missiles that are pointed at them that are loaded with nuclear weapons or can be loaded with nuclear weapons. The only way that they can create an acceptable environment is by establishing peaceful coexistence, and that President Moon has explicitly said that's his number one objective. Whereas President Trump is hopeful that by some arms control actions, he can remove the threat to the United States of North Korea's nuclear weapons.
All right, that is Bruce Bennett, senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation. President Donald Trump's administration weakened environmental controls on coal production Tuesday, overturning national regulations set by former President Barack Obama in his efforts to slow global warming. Environmental Protection Agency Assistant Administrator Bill Wareham said the Obama plan boosted power bills, while the new one will cut them.
We would expect electricity prices in the country to fall, to go down somewhere in the range of 0.2 to 0.5% in 2025.
He said it will now allow individual coal-producing states to set their own rules for carbon emissions rather than to adhere to an overall countrywide standard. The plan is subject to a 60-day comment period before it's finalized. Joining us now to discuss is Daniel Reisel, New York attorney with Sive Paget and Reisel, the nation's first environmental law firm. How could this decision impact health and the climate?
Even the new proposal indicates there will be an increase in death and mortality and sickness. Dispute as to how bad it will be, but there can be no doubt that it's not going to be better for human health. The bigger picture, of course, is that the Clean Power Plan was that and the gas restrictions, the fleet restrictions on cars, were the two principal ways that Obama was implementing the promises we made internationally. And we're intended to, be the main part of our effort to reduce global warming gases, which you just got to go outside on any day and figure out that it's a problem. We cannot really start talking about global warming is coming. We're feeling the impacts of it every day, and scientists tell us that fast approaching a tipping point. And so the Obama administration, in league with other industrial countries, had agreed to reduce carbon emissions, and this was a central aspect of that proposal to reduce carbon, make significant carbon emissions to prevent the Earth from tipping over to a point of no return. So we have both short-range increased bad health effects and long-term, but not so long-term, overarching environmental impacts. Aside from the natural attrition of coal-fired plants, due to the plants are aging and you can't really, it's very difficult to build a cost-effective coal-fired plant. Very few people are doing that. I think one was built recently, but it's not. People are not building coal-fired plants because natural gas, outperforms and is much less polluting. And, of course, we're increasing our efficiencies and use of energy and renewables like solar, water, and wind. and maybe even atomic energy are increasing. So that's becoming an increasing and cost-effective element in reducing carbon. And the important point is that EPA exceeded its statutory authority. That's a legal interpretation of whether it had sufficient power under the Clean Air Act to impose these type of restrictions on individual plants.
Right, that was actually my next and last question to you, was what are the legal ramifications, if any, and are environmentalists likely to sue over this?
There'll be no end of litigation. Litigation will take the form of opposing the rescission of the Clean Power Plan. There has to be a rational basis for that.
All right, that's Daniel Reisel, New York attorney with Saif, Paget, and Reisel. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Population growth and rising sea levels will increase pressure on our farmlands to grow more food, but one British design graduate is hoping to combat that sobering trend with her concept of a floating farm at sea. VOA's Julie Tabeau has more.
Layla Clark may be on the verge of revolutionizing ancient agricultural practices. The British design graduate has created a prototype for a floating farm that she hopes will allow people to grow vegetables at sea. Her scaled-down model uses evaporation to provide fresh water inside the dome structure.
The basic idea is what this sits in the water. Water comes up inside the plant area. Then the condensation will rise, land on the domes outside, so the plants get fed the pure water.
The natural desalination process means there's no need for expensive pumps or filtration systems. And as the weather gets hotter, more water evaporates. The higher the temperature, the better it works.
So this just allows kind of like physics to take care of it. You know, things heat up, they evaporate, they cool down, they condense.
Clark believes such projects will become more necessary in coming years as scientists predict rising sea levels and global temperatures will render formerly fertile farmland less productive. And as the world's population rises, so does the need to grow more food.
So I was kind of wanting to tackle two birds, one stone. Like, the increased population is going to need more food to support them, and also we're going to need somewhere else to grow our food since the farmland isn't going to be available anymore.
Clark did 2 months of experimentation using various methods to test desalination and plant growth rates in both still and rough waters.
And then actually ended up making my own rig just on a rocking chair with a large glass fish tank, which was actually the best because I could record things the most kind of consistently.
Clark has grown both chard and spinach greens on the device and thinks radishes would also grow well. She hopes to eventually receive commercial funding to scale up the project. Julie Tabeau, VOA News.
While the Eagles' Greatest Hits album has moonwalked past Michael Jackson's Thriller to become history's best-selling album of all time in the U.S., the Recording Industry Association of America said Monday that the Eagles' album, The Greatest Hits, 1971 through 1975, is now certified 38-time platinum, which means sales and streams of the album have reached 38 million copies. It was released in 1976 and pushes Jackson's Thriller to second place. The Industry Association of America also said the Eagles' Hotel California, released in 1977, is now 26 times platinum and makes it the third best-selling album of all time. The Eagles, who formed in Los Angeles in the early 1970s, mastered the mix of rock and roll and country music, and the band's hits, Hotel California, Take It Easy, among others, became part of the soundtrack of that decade. They broke up in 1980, coming back together 14 years later, with Don Henley and Glenn Frey being the only remaining original members. Frey died in 2016, but the Grammy-winning band remains on tour. The band was also inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1998 and received the Kennedy Center honor in 2016. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day. Well, I'm running down the road, trying to loosen my load. Got a world of trouble on my mind. Looking for a lover who won't blow my cover. She's so hard to find. Take it easy. Take it easy. Don't let the sound of your own.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to Human Rights Watch, a person is considered to have disappeared when he or she is last seen in the custody of government forces, but state authorities refuse to admit they have detained the person or to offer any information of the detainee's fate. And that is what has been happening in Syria since the uprising began in early 2011. Thousands of people have disappeared into government prisons, and most of them were never heard from again. Yet despite repeated requests for information by families of the disappeared, Syrian authorities consistently denied having any knowledge of those detained or those who were last seen in their custody. Until May of this year, that is. That's when Syrian authorities began to update civil registries, indicating that thousands of people detained or disappeared since 2011 have died. Frequently, the cause of death is listed as a heart attack. The Syrian regime's recent notices confirming the deaths of thousands of political prisoners in its custody affirms what the international community has long suspected and can never forget. The regime has systematically arrested, tortured, and murdered tens of thousands of Syrian civilians in response to their legitimate and nonviolent calls for their freedom, rights, and political reforms, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert in a written statement. Human rights organizations report that at least 117,000 Syrians have been detained or forcibly disappeared since the uprising began, she said. The vast majority of them are believed to be in regime custody across a network of prisons where regime officials torture and murder civilians to intimidate and silence any opposition to Assad's rule. Extensive documentation and other evidence of this torture and murder is being collected by international organizations and support the world's continued condemnation of the Syrian regime and prosecution of culpable officials in various courts, said Heather Nauert. The United States strongly reiterates its condemnation of the Assad regime's cruel actions and calls on it to adhere to international laws and norms pertaining to the treatment of prisoners, including by allowing access for independent monitors. We will continue to work with the international community to investigate and shed light on these nefarious activities and work to hold those responsible accountable.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.